Okay, so this is File 241, and it is Tuesday, October 12th. We're finishing up special census today, maybe moving on to endocrine system. And I just want to put a table on the board regarding all of the senses in the inner ear, middle ear, external ear. And we're talking about the labyrinth, and the labyrinth is the series of chambers inside the temporal bone. But in what particular region of the temporal bone is this? This is just a blast from the past, some anatomy. Right? What's that part of the temporal bone between the external acoustic meatus and the internal acoustic meatus called? That's the petrous region, right? The petrous region of the temporal bone. Okay? So let's see if we can get the display to work via the projector as well as on the board. All right, so what are the three senses of the labyrinth? We've got three senses. All right, is that showing? Yeah, pretty good. What are the three senses? What? I can't hear you.
Hearing.
All right, so hearing is one. Yeah, you're doing good. Hearing is really good. The second kind of sense is it's an equilibrium sense, but remember there are two. What's the simplest one? Just linear acceleration. Sometimes we call that static equilibrium. I'm going to have to shrink my writing a little bit. Equilibrium, but you can see that just fine. And that's just another way of saying what kind of acceleration? That is linear acceleration. Now, what the heck is acceleration? I'm going to abbreviate acceleration, just ACC. What does acceleration mean? It's a change in speed. Yeah, so if you speed up or slow down, or even if you change directions, that is acceleration. Okay, and then the third sense in that petrous region is what we call kinetic equilibrium. When I erase on the board, it doesn't erase up over there. So I got to spell things right the first time. Oh, that's tough. Kinetic equilibrium. All right, and what kind of motion is that? That is angular or spinning, right? So not just linear, but it's some rotational kind of acceleration. All right, so what do we call that? Angular. Angular acceleration. All right, so you got three main parts of the ear. What are the three main parts of the ear? Yeah, so you got inner, but let's start with the other one. Outer, external ear or outer, that's fine. All right, so I'm going to put external ear, right? Then, oh, nope, ow, rats. Now, how do I erase that? Cursor, I need a cursor. Where's the cursor? Ah, there it is. So, if I do that, and that, delete, and that, external ear, okay? Did it wrong again. Good thing we can delete. Okay? And then if I erase with this, it goes away here. Okay, middle, right? All right, middle ear, and I'm not going to put ear because I'm going to run out of board. And then we have what? Internal. Internal ear. So for hearing, which one of these parts of the ear do you need in order to hear stuff?
Middle.
Middle? Because what's in the middle? Yeah, you got those auditory ossicles. If they don't vibrate back and forth, right, then you're not going to hear anything. That's what we call conduction deafness if that happens. All right, but what happens if you got a big plug of earwax in the ear? Can you hear? No. So you need what? You need the external ear and middle ear. All right, if your external ear is plugged up with something, that's what we call conduction deafness again. And I think you maybe talked about that. Did you get to hearing yet in lab? Yeah? Okay. So you need the external ear and middle ear. So we're going to put for hearing, yes. Middle ear, yes. What about internal ear? Are there any structures in the internal ear that have to function properly in order to hear? Absolutely, right? And if that structure doesn't behave correctly, that's called sensory neural or neuri deafness, sensory neuri deafness. So we have yes for the internal ear. Now, as far as equilibrium is concerned, for static equilibrium, do you need an external ear? All right, if you plug your ear up like this and you can't hear yourself, Do you lose your balance? No. So you don't need an external ear for static equilibrium. All right, what about kinetic equilibrium? You don't need an external ear for that either. So big no, like that. All right, middle ear is a no for both forms of equilibrium. But you need the internal ear for static equilibrium and kinetic equilibrium. Sometimes kinetic is also called dynamic equilibrium, kinetic or dynamic equilibrium. So it's a big yes for both of those. All right, so that's some of the gross anatomy. Now, there is a bony labyrinth that is responsible for these three senses. So I'm going to put down just bony right here, but remember, it's really part of the labyrinth right here. What's the name of the bony labyrinth for hearing? Looks like a snail. It's a cochlea. All right, so that's the cochlea. For static equilibrium, it's the middle part, and we call that the vestibule. And for angular acceleration, it's those circular things. What do we call that? Yeah, the semicircular canals. Semicircular canals. And there are three of them, but I'll just say one right here, semicircular canal. Now, inside the bony labyrinths, there's a membranous labyrinth. Maybe this is just a review from anatomy. Oh, I'm almost running out of space right here on the board. All right, let's try it. All right, and I'm going to have to abbreviate, membranous labyrinth. So let's know what the name of the membranous labyrinth is. For hearing, it's the cochlear duct. All right, so cochlear duct. And in the vestibule, anybody remember what that's called? There are two. Yeah, utricle and saccule. Really good. Utricle and saccule. Those are the two. And then for the semicircular canals, the membranous labyrinth is the semicircular ducts. That's pretty good. And inside this membranous labyrinth, there are organs for detecting these various senses right here. All right, so what's the organ that's necessary for hearing? We might be able to fit it on the board if I really squeeze it in. Organ of Corti. And that is for hearing, right? All right, so let's see, hearing. Yeah, so I'm going to put like organ right here. And it is really is the organ of Corti, but I'm just going to put Corti right here. But it really is the organ of Corti. And that's a capital C because that's named after somebody. All right, you're smiling because this is all routine for you. Now, what's the organ for linear acceleration? It's the, well, Krista's close. It's called the, one is called a macula. All right, so the utricle has a macula and the saccule has a macula. Both of them, the plural would be maculae. All right, so macula. M-A-C-U-L-A, macula. And for dynamic equilibrium or angular acceleration, that would be the, somebody said a crista something, it's actually two words. Yeah, the crista ampullaris. Crista ampullaris. That's the organ. Now, the reason why I'm kind of putting this in a really ragged-looking table on the board, okay, is so that you can relate this to a picture in your mind. What do these structures look like? For instance, the cochlea, what does it look like? Kind of like a snail, right? And the organ of Corti is what? It's got some different membranes. It's got the tectorial membrane and basement membrane to it. Right, so you should go back to your book or anatomy book and just make sure that you have some sort of picture in your mind. All right, so these are the receptor organs. And the last thing that we're interested in is the actual receptor cell. What cells are responsible for these three special senses? Oh, why are these special senses as opposed to general? They're a relatively complicated, highly organized organ, and they're only in one or two places in your body, right? Like you can't hear things with your belly button or shoulder, elbow, anything like that. All right, so these different organs, the organ of Corti, the maculae, and the crista ampullaris, have specialized receptor cells that produce these generator potentials, right, which then instigate action potentials on sensory nerves. So what about the receptor? Here's an E. Receptor cells. All right, so here's the receptor organ, Corti, maculae, crista ampullaris. What kind of cells are employed by the organ of Corti for hearing? Hair cells. Are you kidding me? A hair cell? You're not kidding me. You are right. It's a hair cell. Because it's just a cell that has all these stereocilia poking off of them that kind of look like hairs. All right, they're not hairs like you have on your head. They're microscopic stereocilia, but nonetheless, underneath the microscope, they kind of look like hair, right? So we call it a hair cell. What about for static equilibrium? What kind of receptor cells are they? What kind of receptor cell? I know somebody knows back there. Who knows? Who knows? Somebody said a hair cell. Are you kidding me? A hair cell again? They're all hair cells. As a matter of fact, you are right. They're all hair cells. They're almost identical cells. All right, but they are built into different kinds of organs, and when those hairs get bent, it starts generator potentials, which can increase or decrease the frequency of action potentials on the vestibulocochlear nerve, which then will either go to the auditory center or equilibrium centers in the brain. All right, so this is kind of interesting how exactly the same kind of cell has been recruited to do different jobs in the body, right? Vastly different kinds of perceptions, hearing versus equilibrium senses, all rely on the same kind of receptor cell. All right, so I find that kind of amazing. All right, so maybe I'll put this into a Word document or something and put it on Blackboard for you since that sort of worked out okay. Maybe I'm going to turn the lights down just a little bit. Maybe it's easier to see with that light down a little bit. Okay, I don't know what this switch does. Well, that's down maybe a little bit too much. Okay, well, I can only get one projector on because I would actually like to leave this slide up, but I can only get one projector to turn on. So what we're going to do is I'll leave this on the board. I don't think I need that on the board, but to go to the PowerPoint slides, then I need to go to this right here. No, this button here. This one here. Okay. All right, so I actually wanted to project this at the same time as the other slide, right? So here you see, okay, it's adjusting itself. Amazing. So here's the external ear, right? Here's the middle ear. So any abnormalities in the outer or middle ear that produce deafness, as we call conduction deafness, any abnormalities in the inner ear, starting with the cochlea right here, that produce deafness, as we call sensory neurodeafness. All right, so two different kinds of deafness, and of course you have to treat either of those differently. So that's it for the special senses in the petrous region of the temporal bone, which are what? Hearing, static equilibrium, and dynamic equilibrium. Okay, so how do I have to come over here? I can't change slides. There's a reason why I can't. Why can't I change slides? Ah, now I can. Okay. All right, so we talked about all that last time. So that takes us to vision. And vision, of course, is a special sense because you can't see with your fingertips, elbow, right, shoulder blade, anything like that, only with your eyes. Relatively complicated organ. And the eyes are sensitive to visible light. There's a question online that says, can you see in the ultraviolet region? But you can't. I've never known anybody to see in the ultraviolet region, even if they lose a part of their eye, like the lens, for instance. And There's a name of a person that can describe the colors that you see in a rainbow. Does anybody know the name of a person that describes? Yeah, Roy G. Biv, right? So how about if I put that down here? R-O-Y. Oh, but that's not on your screen anymore. Okay, Biv. I don't think I want to flip back. So R stands for red, orange, yellow, green, blue, indigo, and violet. That's just the colors of the natural light spectrum or solar spectrum that most normal vision people can see. So what do we have over here? So this is red, and this is orange, right? And this is yellow. And then we got green. How am I doing? I have no idea what I'm pointing at, but I'm reading it off the board. All right, so in sunlight, which is white light, if we break white light down into its various colors, these are actually different wavelengths of energy, and when the wavelength of energy changes, the energy level changes. All right, so this is what we have in white light. If you shine this through a prism, these are all the different colors that break apart because of refraction. All right, so what are some structures of the eye? There are some structures that are primarily responsible for vision, and then there are others that help that primary structure do its job. The primary structure is the retina. Other structures are what we call accessory structures, like eyebrows and eyelids and eyelashes. What do those things do? They protect your eye, right? Okay. Other structures not primarily involved with vision help focus light on the retina, and those would be things like the cornea and the lens, right? And also something called the iris. So here is the iris. That is smooth muscle. It has two different kinds of smooth muscle in it, and it adjusts itself depending on the intensity of light. So if it's very dim, right, the iris contracts, and in particular, okay, these radial fibers contract, and it pulls the iris open. All right, so more light enters the eye in dim light conditions, and that is a sympathetic response. Alright, so these radial fibers are stimulated by the sympathetic nervous system that will dilate your eyes, make your pupil bigger. When it's really, really bright outside, alright, then these circular fibers contract, and they're controlled by the parasympathetic nervous system. So that's why pupil constriction or dilation we consider antagonistic, because of the way that the pupil either constricts or dilates, and that's due to the two differences in the autonomic nervous system. So dilation is sympathetic due to the radial fibers, and constriction is due to parasympathetic stimulation due to these circular fibers in the iris. Right? And then that can adjust perfectly so that you can see in both dim light and bright light at the same time. Alright, so those are some accessory structures. And from anatomy, you probably learned that in order to focus light on the retina, it requires two structures. There is a lens that focuses light on the retina, but there's actually something that has more power for focusing light on the retina, and it has curvature as well. Just like the lens has curvature to it, there's another structure of the eye that is transparent that has curvature, and it's even more important for focusing light on the retina, and that is the cornea right here, the cornea, okay? All right, so the cornea does not change shape on a minute-to-minute basis, but the lens can change shape depending on how far away the object is that you're trying to see clearly. All right, so the cornea is fixed, but the lens can change its shape. It can help you focus up close, or it can help you focus on something far away. And that process of changing that distance of focus is what we call accommodation. And that is due to a muscle right here that we call the ciliary muscle. And it's going to adjust the curvature or the thickness of the lens and allow you to focus on a couple different distances. All right, so how does this work? At distances greater than 20 feet away, the ciliary muscle relaxes. Right, and when it relaxes, when the ciliary muscle relaxes right here, it expands. The circle gets bigger. And as it does, as it gets bigger, then it puts tension on these suspensory ligaments, which then puts tension on the lens right here, which flattens it out. Okay, makes it nice and tight. So That means then that you can see something far away when that happens, right? But as the distance decreases, then the light has to be bent a little bit differently. It has to be bent more because the light rays are more divergent. Then the ciliary muscle starts to contract, and when that circular muscle contracts, the circle gets smaller. And as the circle gets smaller, that reduces tension on the suspensory ligaments, and that allows then the lens, right, to go back to a thicker position, which means it has more curvature. So it will bend light to a greater degree so that you can focus on something close to you. All right, so that process of changing the shape of the lens right here is what we call accommodation. In order to see things up close, the lens has to be highly curved. To see things far away, the lens has to be more flat. It shouldn't bend light quite so much. All right, so that process is called accommodation. But you should never forget, what are the two things that help focus light on the retina, which is back over here? It is the shape of the cornea and the shape of the lens. And actually, the shape of the cornea is even more important. The reason why we have a lens is so that we can see things up close clearly, as well as things far away clearly, but not at the same time, right? Your eye automatically adjusts. So for instance, we could do a really quick experiment. If you raise your index finger and stick it out in front of you at arm's length and focus on your fingertip, all right, and then you look, you can see the room behind your fingertip, but how does it look? Blurry, okay? Now, if you focus on the room behind your finger, what does your finger look like? It's blurry, right? So you can only focus on one object at a time. That's just a law of physics, all right? Now, unfortunately, what happens to this lens as we get older? It loses elasticity, right? It stops changing, and the muscle gets a little bit older, gets slower. So not only can't you see things up close anymore, it takes longer to accommodate, right? So you might have noticed this. Like when somebody's driving down the 405 freeway at about 30 miles an hour, okay, and you pass them by, okay, you probably already know what kind of person is in that car, right? And what is the reason for that? Well, because they just can't accommodate to the same efficiency as us younger people, okay? And so they drive slowly because why? They don't want to get a speeding ticket. Because if you get a speeding ticket when you're 80 years old, what happens? They probably yank your driver's license, right? And then you're just stuck at home. So that's why they drive 30 miles an hour. They're looking at the speedometer, okay? But that's probably the last place they want to be is on the 405 freeway, right? Because you might miss an exit, and then you got to travel another 10 miles and turn around, make life really complicated. So not only are you driving 30, you look up from the speedometer, and you look down the road, and what do you see? Because you can't accommodate so fast anymore, it's just a big blur. And then 1001, 1002, 1003, then everything pops into focus, all right? And then you breathe a sigh of relief because you can see your exit and you know you didn't pass it. But now what happens? What are you concerned about? Speeding. So then you look back down at the speedometer, okay, and what do you see at the speedometer? Nothing is blurry, right? 1001, 1002, 1003, and then it pops into focus, and you're not speeding. And you go, oh, thank God, I'm not speeding. I don't lose my license. But now what are you worried about? Are you going to miss your exit? And you look down the road, and what do you see? It's nothing. It's a blur, right? Until you can accommodate once again. All right, so when you see those viejitos driving out there, just be kind to them because they just don't see quite as well. Give them a lot of room, all right, and just be nice and gentle. Stay out of their way. Because of what? Accommodation. That's the process of adjusting the shape of this lens right here. Okay. All right. So that's sort of related to visual acuity, but not exactly. All right. Notice that in each one of these circumstances, we're going to talk about near vision and far vision and astigmatism. Notice that the lens is the same shape in each one of these cases right here. But there are some abnormalities in vision because the shape of the cornea doesn't match up with the length of the eyeball exactly in these circumstances. All right, so emmetropia is a condition where you have normal vision. You have the proper curvature of the cornea, right, so that the light rays from faraway objects, light rays are going to be parallel from faraway objects, focus exactly on the retina right here. So the distance from the cornea to the retina is perfect so that it focuses just fine. So that gives you good normal vision. Typically we call that 20/20, right? So you got to know some of that stuff for lab. And if you have 20/20 vision, you don't need any kind of correction when that happens. All right, but if you're myopic, for instance, right here, that means that your eyeball is too long and light focuses in front of the retina and then it starts to diverge again. It gets blurry by the time it hits the retina so that things are blurry. So in this particular case, this is what we call nearsightedness because the light focuses where? In front of the retina. And in order to correct for this, then you need a concave lens which spreads the light out so that it focuses at a farther distance from the cornea so then people can see. All right, hyperopia, on the other hand, farsightedness means that when you're looking at a far object, the light rays are parallel, the light focuses behind. So the eyeball is too short. All right, so that needs a different kind of corrective lens, namely this convex lens, which then starts to bend the light, right, together before it hits the cornea so that by the time it goes to the cornea and lens, it now focuses on the retina right here. So this is what we call far vision because it focuses, what, too far behind the retina. All right, so this is a pretty good exam figure. So know the names of these lenses, what condition this is called, right, near vision because it's in front of the retina, far vision because it's behind the retina. And then astigmatism means that there is some asymmetry in the cornea and some parts are focused properly and other parts of the lens don't focus properly. So when you look at something in a plane, some part of the plane is in focus but some other part of the plane is out of focus. So you need an aspherical lens to correct for astigmatism when that happens. All right, and I suppose now there are even good contact lenses that can correct for astigmatism and maybe even a LASIK procedure. All right, what does that LASIK procedure do? Okay, it doesn't adjust the shape of the lens, it adjusts the shape of the cornea, which is even more sensitive and better to do than changing the shape of the lens. And fortunately, the cornea is where? Right there, very superficial, right? You don't have to dig around in somebody's eyeball to get at it, so it's a pretty nice, slick procedure to change the shape of the cornea so that you can have perfect 20/20 vision. Well, but I don't recommend people do it for cosmetic reasons, right? If your vision is so poor in the morning that you can't even find your glasses, right, then LASIK is a great procedure. It will change your life, right? But for cosmetic reasons, I don't know if I really buy into that because it will only change your vision, correct your vision for that one point in time in your life, right? And then as your vision changes, people say LASIK can be revised a number of times. I'm not so sure how well that works. And people can also make mistakes. Computers can make mistakes, and you're dealing with your vision, your eyes, and that would be terrible if something goes wrong during that procedure, and it does every once in a while. What are some other things that I don't like about that procedure? Here is an interesting one. As you get older, because your lens has trouble accommodating because it gets stiff, right? Not only do you need faraway glasses to see far away, you also need reading glasses for near vision, okay? And you might have noticed that some of us viejitos, when we read something up close, what do? We can take our glasses off, right? And I don't need reading glasses. I can still see close up if I take my glasses off. But if I put my glasses on, then things up close are blurry. Well, that's exactly the same thing that happens when you get a LASIK procedure. If you get your vision corrected for far away, guess what you lose when you're in middle age? You lose your near vision. And I've known a lot of people to get a LASIK procedure and they're thrilled because they can see clearly far away, and then they get a phone call on their cell phone and take the cell phone out of their pocket, and guess what? They don't even know how to use their cell phone anymore because they can't see it without using reading glasses. So hopefully if you get a LASIK procedure, okay, you go to a reputable physician that tells you all these things ahead of time before you plunk down how much it costs. I don't know what it costs. $5,000, something like that. Because you might get really good far vision, but you might give up near vision and have to wear glasses for that condition. But if you're a prize fighter, right, or a football player, and you make a couple $1 million by fighting somebody Saturday night, I would get the LASIK procedure, right? That's great. So for business purposes or other kinds of purposes, that's fine. But maybe not just for cosmetic reasons, yeah.
Is it true that if you wear glasses all the time, it makes your eyes?
I don't have any experience. I've heard that, and I've heard that there are exercises that you can use, visual exercises, so that you can, that will improve your vision. But what do you have to change in order to affect your vision? You have to change the shape of your eyeball. So I'm not sure those exercises will help that very much. But that also means that as you age, the shape of your eyeball changes and your vision is going to change. And some people's vision gets better, right? It just changes in a way that makes their vision gets better, at least their farsightedness. All right, so it just kind of all depends on how things change. So I'm not sure if I can answer that question. Okay, that would be cool. And then it would be nice to know how to do those exercises. All right, so that's accommodation. All right, so let's look at the primary structures for vision, and that's the retina, right? That's the neural tunic within the eye. And let's see, what do I want to say about that? Basically, all right, there are two kinds of receptor cells for vision. All right, you have rod cells and cone cells. These cone cells are drawn a little bit big to scale. The cone cells are actually quite a bit smaller, so they need more light in order to work compared to the rod cells. Rod cells are bigger, all right, that casts a bigger net so it can catch more light. It's more sensitive. And the rod cells are good for black and white or gray vision. The rod cells can see gradations in just black and white. The cone cells, because they're small, give you very high resolution images in color. But in order to see high resolution in color, it has to be bright light. It can't be in dim light. So if you're outside at night and there's a full moon, you're using your rod cells and it's probably very difficult to see colors. Of course, I'm kind of making that up, right? It's always difficult for me to see colors. But nonetheless, that's what I've been told. But here's something interesting. Okay, I still have cone cells. If you go outside at night and look at a star, okay, the population of these cells is different depending on where they are in the retina. And there's one place in the retina that gives you your best vision. It gives you your central vision, and that's called the fovea centralis. And I don't think I have a slide of the retina anywhere here. Do I? No, I really don't. Okay, but you'll have to remember where the macula lutea is, and the very center part of the macula lutea is the fovea centralis, and that's what you use your extrinsic eye muscles to do. You position your eye so that the object that you're looking at goes right back to the fovea centralis. All right, and the fovea centralis has these cone cells, which gives you your best, sharpest vision and in color. But remember, what's the trade-off? What don't they do well? See in dim light, right? So if you're outside at night and you look directly at a star, right, going to the fovea centralis where there are only cone cells, it might disappear, okay? And if you look at that star, not directly on it, but off to the side a little bit, using your peripheral vision, which is populated more with rod cells right there, right, the star will pop into vision. But I bet you couldn't tell if it was a yellow star or blue star or white star or whatever, because some stars have colors associated with them, right? Okay, so peripheral vision is where the rods are. These are good for looking at things in dim light, but only, what, gray vision. The cone cells are in your central vision. It gives you high acuity and color, but only in bright light. All right, so this part right here, where I have the cursor right now, this is the part of the eye, which is the vitreous humor. Right, so this is the deepest part. So light has to pass through all these different layers of neurons before it gets to the photoreceptors, which is kind of strange. Okay, and it will stimulate either a rod or cone cell. So we have some different kinds of cells. Remember way back when we said bipolar cells are important for special senses. So here is a layer of bipolar cells. There are some horizontal neurons, what we call horizontal cells, which interact with various rods and cone cells. And again, these amacrine cells can influence what you're seeing before these potentials get to the ganglion cells, which then take light into the optic nerve, and then into the optic chiasm, and then into the optic tract. So all of these different layers of cells right here can influence how you perceive things and what you perceive. So there's a lot of processing that takes place in the retina. That's all I want you to know about these various cells right here. So that these help process light information before it even gets to your brain, where you do even more processing of light information. All right, what I really want to focus on are how these cells right here work, how the receptor cells work. All right, so this is a better representation of the relative size of a cone and a rod cell. And we see that both of these cells have an inner segment, which contains cytoplasm. And it has like an axon terminal right here, which we just call synaptic endings. And it has an outer segment that's kind of pointed away from where the light is actually entering the eye. And these are where the photopigments are there in the outer segment. So this is the part of the cell that can interact with light, not the inner segment right here, but the outer segment. And there are things called discs, right? Visual discs within the outer segment that can interact with light. All right. Some of these other layers of the retina, for instance, this pigmented epithelium right here absorbs light so that it doesn't bounce around inside your eyeball, which is important because then you would see flashes of light. These outer segments of rods and cone cells are always being regenerated from more of this basal region, and they're sloughed off at the apical region, and so this debris doesn't just sit around inside your eye. This pigmented epithelium then phagocytizes that debris so that your eye doesn't get all plugged up with debris. And it also delivers nutrients to these other layers of the retina, these neuronal cells. Right, because remember, only the choroid has blood vessels. And so the pigmented epithelium helps deliver nutrients to these cells right here. And it also stabilizes ion levels. So they kind of act like astrocytes almost to some degree. Right, because why don't you want blood vessels in the retina right here? What would happen? If you had a big blood vessel right here, it would push the rods and cone cells out of the way, and then you don't have any photoreceptors, and that would produce a vision deficit. Unfortunately, that happens in some people, or used to happen in some people, called retinopathy of prematurity. I don't have time to talk about that. But if you're interested in knowing something about that, that happened in premature babies, sometimes when they were placed in an incubator, and where they're placed in a high oxygen atmosphere, so oxygen would diffuse in through the cornea, through the vitreous humor, into the retina, and that high oxygen concentration would stimulate the growth of blood vessels from the choroid layer into the retina. All right, and so now it's always it takes a lot of good clinical judgment to adjust the atmosphere in incubators, right, so that it's high enough so that the infant isn't in respiratory distress, but not so high that it causes the development or angiogenesis of blood vessels in the retina, producing a vision deficit. All right, so that's why it's another good reason why you should know different layers of all these different tissues. All right, so let's talk about some of the chemical reactions that take place in a rod cell right here. So we're going to kind of just focus on black and white vision and use that as a model to figure out how color vision works as well. All right, so there is a chemical compound that's called rhodopsin. And here is a rhodopsin molecule. All right, so it's a part protein, and then there is a retinol molecule they associate. So remember that if you have this long hydrocarbon chain right here, if you put a double bond, that puts a little kink in the molecule. And depending on where these kinks are placed, you can have what we call a cis conformation or a trans conformation. And notice that it changes the shape of the molecule. The cis retinol has a little hook to it, but the trans retinol is just a straight linear molecule. And when it changes shape, guess what? It doesn't fit in the opsin protein anymore, right? And so that reaction, when rhodopsin absorbs light, the cis retinol changes conformation to a trans retinol because light really is energy. Right, and different colors of light have different amounts of energy, and that retinol molecule can absorb that energy and change conformation, and it can no longer fit in the opsin molecule. And that's eventually going to change some permeability of the cell membrane. And when you change permeability of the cell membrane to various ions, then you change the electrical properties of that cell, which means you can do what? What are the two ways you can change the electrical properties of a cell? You can depolarize, or you can hyperpolarize that cell, right? Depolarizing is excitatory, hyperpolarizing is inhibiting the cell. Okay, and so that's what happens when rhodopsin absorbs light. And this is just a molecular description. But I want to talk about more of the physiologic events inside the cell. And I'm going to go back and go over these text slides in a little bit, but I think we want to look at some of the images first. Okay, so there is a compound. Remember cyclic AMP? Where does cyclic AMP come from? It comes from ATP, right? Comes from ATP, and there is an enzyme that can convert ATP into cyclic AMP. What was that called? That's called adenylate cyclase, right? Adenylate cyclase will change ATP into cyclic AMP, and it takes off two phosphate molecules. And what is cyclic AMP? How did you run into cyclic AMP? It acts as a second messenger, right, inside the cell. So it's a part of a signal transduction scheme that, right, can change a signal that's stuck outside the cell into a signal that is inside the cell. So it has to do with transduction. Okay. Well, here we have a disc in the outer segment of a rod cell. And so this is a rhodopsin molecule right here. And here's a cis retinol molecule. Also associated with this disc is one of those really fancy G proteins that we've been talking about with these different subunits right here. Okay, and then here is the plasma membrane of that cell. And remember, light can penetrate the cell, it goes in. And under dark conditions, right, there is plenty of cyclic GMP around, and that cyclic GMP binds to this sodium channel, and when it binds, it keeps the sodium channel open. So sodium is entering the cell because, remember, what's the inside of the cell? It's negative. Sodium is positive, so it's drawn in. It's also high sodium outside, low sodium inside. That also draws sodium inside the cell. So there is this sodium current, or just diffusion, of sodium inside the cell. When sodium enters this rod cell, what happens to the membrane potential? It changes in which way? Hyperpolarizes or depolarizes? It depolarizes. So this is really strange because most times you think of when a system is being stimulated, that's when the cell depolarizes. But why is this rod cell depolarizing? It's depolarizing in the absence of stimulation, right, in the dark. So this is a different kind of scheme than what we're used to. All right, so in the dark, in the absence of stimulation, this rod cell is depolarizing because sodium is entering the cell. All right, then when we apply a stimulus to this rod cell, light enters, it causes the cis conformation of retinol to change to trans, all right, and it dissociates from the opsin that activates the G protein, and this alpha subunit then bumps into phosphodiesterase. And phosphodiesterase, I don't think we've talked about it before, but phosphodiesterase is an enzyme that breaks down either cyclic AMP into regular old AMP or cyclic GMP. Remember, GMP is like adenosine. It's just what, a guanosine triphosphate. It's made in the Krebs cycle, right? The guanosine right there. It converts cyclic GMP into regular old GMP. It just changes the conformation of that molecule. And GMP then no longer can bind to this sodium channel. It dissociates and it causes the sodium channel to close. And when the sodium channel closes in the presence of light, what happens to the electrical property of the cell? It hyperpolarizes, right? It becomes inhibited. So this is strange, that this receptor cell becomes inhibited in the presence of the stimulus due to this mechanism right here. So what's important on this slide? I want you to know that a phosphodiesterase does what? It inactivates a cyclic AMP or cyclic GMP by converting it into a regular old one, What's another enzyme that's used for maybe kind of a similar kind? It has to do with phosphates. It can phosphorylate proteins and other kinds of compounds. What kind of protein is that that phosphorylates something? A kinase, yeah? What kind of enzyme will take a phosphate off of something? A phosphatase. So here is the third kind of enzyme involving phosphorus functional groups, and it's a phosphodiesterase, and it's important for converting a cyclic AMP or cyclic GMP into just a straight linear AMP or GMP, which then wrecks its regulatory capacity. It turns the sodium channel off, right? And then this cell becomes hyperpolarized. All right, so this is what happens in the disc under these two conditions, in the dark and in the light. And the strange thing is that in the dark, that is when the cell is being stimulated, right? It depolarizes in the dark, which is the opposite of just about every other receptor that I can think of. All right, so but why does this work? How does this help us see? Well, here we have a pretty good exam figure. Even the previous figure maybe is an exam figure. We have two conditions, right? We have two columns right here. We've got a rod cell and a rod cell over here, and a bipolar cell, right? And then we have a ganglion cell. We've left off a bunch of the other cells, like the mitral cells and horizontal cells that are performing some regulatory function, but we simplified it a little bit, okay? And under two conditions, in the dark versus in the light. And let's look at the biochemistry that takes place. All right, so in the dark, this is when phosphodiesterase is inactivated. If phosphodiesterase is inactivated, the rod cell builds up high levels of cyclic GMP. With high levels of cyclic GMP, it can bind to the sodium channel, and when cyclic GMP binds to the sodium channel, what happens to it? In the dark, it opens up. Okay? That sodium channel opens up and sodium can enter the cell, which then produces what you just said, what? Depolarization. Okay? And that stimulates the cell. And that depolarization goes all the way down to the synaptic end of this rod cell. And since the cell is depolarizing, guess what's going to happen to these synaptic vesicles? They're going to be released because the cell is depolarized. But now, this neurotransmitter right here is not producing EPSPs in this bipolar cell. It's an inhibitory neurotransmitter, which produces what in this bipolar cell? IPSPs. So that means that in the dark, right, this bipolar cell is inhibited because this neurotransmitter right here is an inhibitory neurotransmitter. So in the dark, the rod cell is being stimulated, but that produces what? Inhibition with the distal neuronal circuit within the retina. So that's why you don't see anything in the dark, because these bipolar cells are being inhibited by release of inhibitory neurotransmitter from the rod cell. So I know this is really backward, but that's how your eye works, okay? So that's why in the dark we talk about the sodium current as being a dark current, right? That dark current is stimulating the rod cell, which actually then inhibits the bipolar cell and you don't see anything, right? And of course you have the sodium-potassium pump restoring the ion balance. All right, let's talk about the other circumstance right here. In light, what happens? Light hits the disc, you get that bleaching reaction, you get that alpha subunit bumping into the phosphodiesterase, and what does phosphodiesterase do? It breaks down all this cyclic GMP, goes to regular GMP, there's no cyclic GMP to keep the sodium channel open, right? And so the sodium channel closes, that hyperpolarizes the cell, and when the cell becomes hyperpolarized, what happens to the release of neurotransmitter right here? It stops, right? And since that's an inhibitory neurotransmitter, that excites the bipolar cell. It will spontaneously then depolarize, and it's going to release excitatory neurotransmitter on the ganglion cell, and then that starts an action potential going to your visual cortex. All right, so it's a very interesting kind of system, but no one would guess that it actually operated in this way. All right, so the dark current happens in what, dark conditions right here? And in light, the phosphodiesterase becomes activated and it just eats up all the cyclic GMP, which then causes stimulation of the ganglion cell because of that inhibitory neurotransmitter. So it's pretty good. It's important that you understand what an EPSP is and what an IPSP is. Okay? So that just kind of builds on that. So let's go back to some of these word slides right here. Electrical activity of the retinal cells. The ganglion and amacrine cells produce action potentials, right? The rods and cones, bipolar and horizontal cells, just produce graded potentials. And these graded potentials could be what? EPSPs or IPSPs, depending on the kind of neurotransmitter is used. And that visual transduction is inverse to other sensory systems. What do we mean by that? It's inverse because the rod cells become stimulated in the absence of the adequate stimulus, which is light. And the rod cells become inhibited in the presence of light. So it's the inverse of most receptor systems. All right, so in dark, photoreceptors release an inhibitory neurotransmitter that hyperpolarizes the bipolar cells. Right? Light inhibits the photoreceptors from releasing inhibitory neurotransmitter, and when that inhibitory neurotransmitter is inhibited, right, that stimulates the bipolar cells, which then sends action potentials to the brain. All right, so rods and cones contain many sodium channels that are open in the dark. That's what we call the dark current, and that dark current goes away, right, producing hyperpolarization when light shines on the rod cells. All right, so that's a really interesting system, and I don't think there's any way that you can really understand what's going on there by reading these words. I think you really have to do what? Maybe draw some of these things out and label this diagram, and then these words are going to make some sense. All right? All right, so that's pretty much it for the senses chapter. Unless there's a question. Yeah. Lateral inhibition, it happens in the retina, but also happens on the surface of your body, all right, where if you have a receptive field, the edges of the receptive field will actually inhibit some of the cells that are being stimulated in the deeper parts of the receptive field, so it increases the resolution, the fine detail. So it makes your appreciation sharper. That's right. Yeah. It makes things sharper. It increases resolution. Another way of thinking of resolution is the sharpness. Yeah. So it could be the sharpness of how you feel things on the surface of your skin. We measure that by what? Two-point discrimination? Or the sharpness of a visual image that you would see. Does it look sharper or blurry? Okay. That's a little bit beyond what I cover in lecture, but maybe in lab you talk about lateral inhibition. Okay. All right, so that's it for senses, chapter 10. So I think we're going to move on then to endocrine system, if I can figure out how to close this window right here. PowerPoint help. No, I don't need help. I just need it to, like, go away or something. I could also click down here. Okay. Endocrinology. So we get to talk about some basic definitions first today. Okay, so that says endocrine glands on the top, right? Endocrine glands. Oh, that projector looks like it's getting dimmer. It's pretty dim today. But you can still see it. Okay, so what the heck is an endocrine gland? Well, we know a number of endocrine glands in our body, right? For instance, testes, ovaries, the pancreas has a part that's endocrine in nature, the adrenal gland is an endocrine gland, both the cortex and the medulla, thyroid gland, and pituitary gland. Oh, here's a pituitary gland right underneath the hypothalamus, connected by the little infundibulum right there. And as a matter of fact, the hypothalamus could be considered an endocrine gland. And so you should know what an endocrine gland is. It's something that produces a product that is secreted when it's told to secrete something. And it doesn't secrete that product into a duct. It just secretes it into the interstitial fluid. And then that product diffuses to a capillary and then into a capillary. And once it's in the capillary, where does it go? All over the body, wherever the blood goes, right? So an endocrine gland are what we call ductless glands, right? And the product that it secretes is what we call a hormone, and it's secreted into the blood, right? And the hormones then go everywhere in the body, and it can have a specific response to what we call target tissues or target cells if those target cells have something special. There's got to be something special about those cells. They have to have a receptor to that particular signaling compound. It's a chemical compound, and a receptor has to match in shape, has to be complementary in shape to the shape of the signaling molecule, right? And you can use the lock and key model to help understand that, like you understood how a substrate binds to an enzyme, for instance, in the active site. Okay, so a hormone is something that is transported by the blood, and it can elicit a specific response in the target cell if that target cell has a receptor for that particular hormone. And we're going to look at some of the specific responses that target tissues can undergo and what some of the hormones are. Then there are other things that we call neurohormones, right? They're a hormone, so they're a product that's secreted by a cell that's picked up by the blood, okay, and then it's transported everywhere in the body. But in order to be a neurohormone, the kind of cell that secretes it has to be a neuron. All right, so usually you think of a neuron secreting something that just diffuses across the synapse that binds to a receptor. Well, we call that kind of compound that a neuron secretes that moves just across the synapse and isn't transported by the circulatory system. That would be a neurotransmitter. And you know a whole bunch of different kinds of neurotransmitters, right? Some are inhibitory, some are excitatory, depending on how they're coupled to various kinds of receptors, right? But a neurohormone is something that's secreted by a neuron that gets picked up by the circulatory system and is delivered to the rest of the body. And hormones then change the metabolism inside the cell. And it can do that by a number of different ways, by maybe opening ion channels or even controlling transcription. And what is transcription? What's transcription? It's a part of what? Part of protein synthesis, right? And what part of protein synthesis is it? The part that happens in the nucleus or the part that happens in the cytosol? It's the part that happens in the nucleus. Transcription converts information in DNA into information in RNA, right? Which is the first step of protein synthesis. So some hormones can change what kind of proteins a cell is making, right? And when you change the kind of proteins a cell is making, you're going to change the function of that particular cell, all right? So hormones are kind of nifty in that respect. All right, so here are a number of hormones. Some of these we're going to talk about, okay? Some of these you're going to have to just kind of memorize. Let's see, some you maybe know something about already, okay? Let's go to the pancreas, for instance. The pancreas, part of the pancreas, what we call the islets of Langerhans, has a couple different kinds of cells. Some of them can secrete insulin, right? And what good is that? What does it help regulate? Yeah, blood sugar. Okay, so if we look over here, the primary effects. Glucagon also can help regulate blood glucose levels, all right? But these are, insulin and glucagon are antagonistic to each other. So is that a good thing or a bad thing? Fantastic thing, right? Because that's how you have precise control and balance over a important physiologic parameter like blood glucose concentration. All right, so you should know that insulin does what to blood glucose? It reduces it, so glucagon is going to increase blood glucose. Those two working in opposition to each other then mix properly so that you have the proper level of glucose in your blood if you have proper regulation of insulin and glucagon. And if you can't make insulin, right, then your blood glucose is way too high all the time, and we call that diabetes mellitus, right? And you've gone and talked about that in lab quite a bit. I got to get my cursor back. Hold on. Okay, now it won't flip away. Here's something that's pretty important. I don't know if we're going to talk about that in this chapter or not, but erythropoietin is a hormone. Oh, what does that mean? Erythropoietin is a hormone. What does that mean, that it's a hormone? It's produced by, what, an endocrine gland, and that endocrine gland secretes it into the interstitial space, and then it's picked up by the blood and delivered everywhere in the body, okay? And there's a target tissue that has a receptor for erythropoietin. What's the target tissue? Bone marrow, and in particular, red bone marrow. Erythropoietin is very important because it helps regulate the production of red blood cells. So when oxygen concentration decreases in your blood, the kidneys can monitor that. It releases erythropoietin, which then goes to red bone marrow that stimulates red blood cell production. That's a pretty important process because how many red blood cells in your body die every second? 1 to 2 million, right? So the kidneys are important, not for just producing urine, but for help regulating red blood cell production so that you don't become anemic. All right, so, okay, then we're going to talk about the anterior pituitary, posterior pituitary, and look at these hormones right here, various trophic hormones. We'll look at the testes that produces testosterone. We'll look at the ovaries that produce estrogen and progesterone. Wow, it's not even on this table right here. All right, so I don't want to just read all of these different things, but let's actually take a look at some of these different endocrine glands and the hormones. All right, but still, first some introductions. The chemical classification of hormones. Just like neurotransmitters, there are some amine hormones, and these are derived from tyrosine and tryptophan. What's tyrosine and tryptophan? Anybody remember what these guys are? They're amino acids, but they're kind of special amino acids, namely why? Because your body can't synthesize them. You need to have them in your diet, right? And then these are used to make norepinephrine, epinephrine, thyroxine, and melatonin. Right, so these are important controlling or signaling molecules, and if you have an inappropriate diet, what happens? Well, all of these different signaling pathways are aberrant. They don't work properly. So that just kind of underscores the importance of a proper diet. Then we have some polypeptide or protein hormones. Right, these are just chains of amino acids. These include antidiuretic hormone, growth hormone. Insulin is like that. It's a small polypeptide, oxytocin, glucagon that we just talked about, a couple others like adrenal corticotropic hormone that acts on the adrenal cortex, parathyroid hormone that helps regulate calcium levels. All right, so we're going to look and see where these come from. Then there's some proteins that have been modified. They've been conjugated with a sugar molecule, so we call these glycoproteins, like luteinizing hormone, follicle-stimulating hormone, thyroid-stimulating hormones are this compound kind of hormone. And then there are steroids. And steroids belong to what class of compounds? Lipids, right? So they're derived in particular from cholesterol. But that's important to know because cholesterol, what kind of compound is cholesterol? Hydrophilic or hydrophobic? Hydrophobic, okay? That means that it has some special abilities. If you're a hydrophobic molecule, what kind of barrier does the plasma membrane present to you? Not much. It means you can diffuse through the plasma membrane. So these kinds of hormones can enter the cell, and we're going to see that has some implications as to what kind of receptors it has and what kind of actions it has on the cell. So some good examples of steroid hormones will be testosterone, estrogen, progesterone, even cortisol from the adrenal cortex. Okay. So here are the steroid hormones. Here's cholesterol. Notice that it just kind of looks like a stairway, right? These different steps right here. And progesterone. And so here's cortisol. Here is testosterone. Here is estradiol. Notice that, and progesterone right here. Notice that all of these compounds are what? Almost exactly the same. Just a couple little modifications of a functional group, maybe from this carbonyl group here to a hydroxyl group changes testosterone into estradiol. And so I just want you to be aware that all these compounds are just related to each other. And the other thing I think that's maybe a little bit interesting is that in order to make estradiol, what does your body have to make first? Testosterone. Okay, it just converted from testosterone. Okay, so that's really all I wanted you to see on this slide. Here is another hormone that is secreted by the thyroid gland, And this is a hydrophobic molecule as well. All right, so this is thyroxine. And thyroxine has activity when it is bound to iodine. Right, so iodine, we don't have the periodic table anymore, but I stands for iodine. And the most efficient form of thyroxine has four iodines on it right here. So we call that tetraiodothreonine, or even better yet, we call it T4. Right? There's another form that's almost as active, but not quite as active. That's T3. It's just missing an iodine right here. All right, but nonetheless, that iodine has to be in your diet because, of course, you can't make iodine in your body in order to make what a proper and efficient kind of thyroid hormone. And because it's hydrophobic, it can diffuse into target cells. So where does that mean the receptors are for this kind of compound? They're inside the cell. Yeah, they're inside the cell. As opposed to hydrophilic kinds of signaling molecules, where are the receptors for hydrophilic signaling molecules? They got to be on the cell exterior on the plasma membrane. Okay. So I think we're going to start here next time, hormonal actions and interactions, right, of hormones. And we'll talk about this a couple times. Here's the sign-in sheet if you need that. And one thing I wanted to look at is the schedule a little bit. Today is the 12th. 1, 2, 3, 4. All right, so we got four lectures left before the next test.